I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is John Levy, a history professor at the University of Chicago and the author of the new book, Ages of American Capitalism, A History of the United States. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So, in the introduction of your book, you mentioned the new history of capitalism, as you say, of which you are a practitioner. Tell us about that historical project and your relationship to it.
Well, I think there's probably two starting points. The first would be that sometime in the late 20th century, history and economics as academic disciplines split and moved apart from one another. There's lots of different reasons for why that occurred, but certainly by the turn of the 21st century, economic issues, economic history was not at the top of the agenda for many academic historians who were interested in social issues, cultural questions, politics, no less important, but nonetheless different kinds of issues than the economy. And then likewise, in many economics departments, history, you know, wasn't at the top of the agenda, given that many economists tend to model and use quantitative methods in which history is certainly applicable, but maybe not as present. So there was a split. And then I think the second starting point would be the financial crisis of 2008, when many historians became newly interested in economic subjects. And you know, I'm a historian, I'm not an economist. And having been trained in a history department and starting my career, you know, right about that time, I got my PhD in 2008. You know, I, along with a number of other scholars in my generation, became interested in the history of capitalism. And you know, why it became the new history of capitalism is because academia is like other fields. There's oftentimes fads and trends, and the kind of term new indicates a new interest within historical research. So there was a new history of capitalism coming out of 2008. And I guess where I fit into that is someone who really wants to integrate history and economics, who really wants to revisit that relationship and finds points of contact between them. And so among kind of historians of capitalism, I would like to think of myself as someone who's interested in engaging economists, economic thinkers, and incorporating their insights into the writing of history.
And then the second half of the title is A History of the United States. Why did you choose that frame for your book?
Well, it builds out of the answer to the first question that you asked. I mean, in wanting to write a book that could integrate economics and history, it meant covering a wide variety of topics: how politics shapes the economy, how economic life shapes culture, how to understand the relationship between society and the evolution of class and groups and identities to larger economic structures. And so I wrote a book. It's one of the reasons why the book is so long, maybe not a justification for its length, but it's one of the reasons why it's so long, is that I tried to cover a lot of different topics to kind of expand the economy and to show that economic life is not a narrow subject about self-interest, about money, about rationality per se, but touches on, in a sense, all aspects of our lives. And so in doing that, at some point in writing the book, I realized that I was writing from a particular perspective, of course, which is, you know, an economic perspective, on what felt to me like a general history of the United States and not just an economic history. And I think the subtitle is there to convey what I'd like to think is the breadth of the book, despite its focus.
And also in your introduction, you almost apologize as a historian for writing what you call a presentist book, one that has an eye on what's going on now. How much did that affect the story you tell in the book?
I think it affected it a lot. I mean, when you train as a historian, and history is a discipline like other academic disciplines, and that means that it disciplines you, it disciplines your thought, it disciplines your approach. One of the things that are ingrained in you as you learn to be a historian is to appreciate the past on its own terms. And that if you're only looking at the past through the eyes of the present, you can warp the past. You can do an injustice to it. And so that's a value that I share as a professional historian. At the same time, as most historians would admit, at the end of the day, we can only write from the perspective of the present because that's the moment we're in. So this is a constant tension that you're always dealing with in your work as a historian. Now, I think because I as I said, entered the profession coming out of 2008, there was an urgency to my teaching and also my research, but especially my teaching, actually, to make sense of that crisis and to fit it within a larger historical narrative. And so for me, you know, my first book was about the 19th century. It ended in basically 1920. But for me, this book I knew was going to come up to the Great Recession, which of course is now quickly becoming in the rear view mirror as part of the past. But I knew the book was going to come up to the present, and I knew I wanted a narrative that would explain the present. And I knew I wanted to find resonances between the present and different moments in the past, going back, you know, to the 17th century where the book begins. And so, as I said, it's a tension that's part of historical scholarship and writing always, but it's a tension that in this book I embraced.
And you write early in the book, maybe coming out of that experience in 2008, you write early in the book, for good and ill, states have illustrated the capacity to orchestrate long-term economic development, which is a theme that runs throughout the book and is especially prominent in the first section, which covers the colonial America and through the early republic. How does the relationship between state and economic development change over the course of the story you tell?
Well, let me start with making two points. You know, one is a general argument that many scholars make, not just me, that politics has a very large role in shaping the economy. You know, one understanding we have of the economy in public culture, in public debate, in politics, is that the economy exists independent of politics, and the government either needs to get out of the way and let the market do its work, or the government has to shape things at the margin, you know, for when the economy goes wrong. And I guess the point of view I present in the book is that we can't disentangle politics and markets. We can't disentangle the state and the economy completely. And the issue is how they interrelate, become interdependent, and then how politics guides the economy. And, you know, you mentioned the first part of the book where I find the origins of American capitalism in the British Empire, in the efforts of the British Empire to extend commerce across North America, and then in the efforts of a new American state, American Republic, coming out of the Revolution, to also extend commerce across space. And the general point there is not just that the state shapes economics, but there's a particular point in which we have to look at how it does it. And that is this issue of long-term investment and long-term development, that really that's where the state matters in charting a long-term course of economic development for polities and societies, and that we can't expect that kind of long-term vision to come from individuals or to come from private initiative per se. So that's kind of the second point about that long-term vision. As I charted across the book, I think you're right that it's very prominent in the first age, the age of commerce, where empires, British and then subsequently the American Republic, set that course. It's there in later parts of the book. You know, the New Deal is another turning point where there's debates about how the New Deal state will control industrial capitalism. But ultimately, I argue that the New Deal state didn't do a particularly good job in setting that long-term course, and that things unraveled in the 70s and 80s. And that one of the, I think, persistent features and persistent problems of American capitalism since then has actually been the lack of a long-term vision that's set by politics, determined by politics and collective action. And that explains, the last age of the book is called the Age of Chaos. It explains why our age has, I think, a kind of chaotic feeling, given the dearth of, I think, long-term imagination and vision. And that the place we have to look for that to come from typically has been the state and our politics.
As you mentioned, John, at several points in the book, you discuss the cultural dimensions of capitalism. And one of those is a chapter where you discuss P.T. Barnum and Henry David Thoreau, and then Herman Melville's novel, The Confidence Man, which is maybe the great novel of American capitalism. Tell us about how that chapter fits into your book and why those figures continue to resonate.
Well, thank you. That's a chapter, as you say, about cultural understandings of commerce and market exchange in the antebellum period. It's a moment, the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, where American thinkers like Barnum, like Thoreau, like Melville, realize that commercialization has accelerated around them, that markets, commerce, exchange is playing a new role, not only in economic life, but also in political, social, and cultural life. And they're trying to make sense of it morally. Now, of course, Barnum, confidence man, is a practitioner of this new market-based culture. And he's a genius at kind of sowing doubt, commercializing doubt, selling doubt to people who visited his museums. He's making money off of it, but he's also thematizing it as he's selling it. You know, Thoreau is a moral critic, and Thoreau presents a moral criticism of commerce. It's a romantic criticism of commerce that I think is still very present in our culture, especially on the left, even though, you know, also among conservatives too, that really critiques the market for not staying in its place, right? For jumping out of its proper boundaries and to impinging upon other realms of our lives, families, friendships, and for corrupting them. And then I present Melville at the end, who I think provides a different point of view and a different kind of critique. You know, he's similarly concerned about the market's ability to swallow other values and swallow other spheres of life. But his idea is that really we need to find ways to appropriate markets, appropriate commerce towards better ends, towards more moral and ethical ends. So for instance, you know, Thoreau doesn't think that markets, commerce spoils friendship. He thinks that in the end, friendship actually can, in bringing trust and bringing confidence, can triumph over some of the concerns that Thoreau had, but also that Barnum's figure presented. I'll say one final point that I think Melville actually has a very interesting economic analysis. We don't typically think of a novelist as being an economist, but I think Melville was very insightful that the fuel of capitalism is an emotional and effective state of confidence and trust. And without that, it doesn't work. Without that, you get things like market panics. With distrust, you know, commerce dries up and capitalism fails. So I think Melville also kind of put his finger on a really important driver of capitalist economies. And to me, you know, it's fascinating to see him working that out in the context of a novel, you know, as opposed to, say, an economic treatise.
Well, what would the equivalent work be today? You quote a paragraph from Thomas Pynchon's novel, The Crying of Lot 49, which is incredibly perceptive about how Silicon Valley is beginning to emerge from the defense industry in California in the 1960s. Is that a book you wish you'd been able to spend more time with? Or is there another book that is really emblematic of the last 50 or 60 years in American capitalism?
Well, you're right. There's a lot more to be said about Pynchon's book. I'll start with a few things. One is the kind of conspiratorial aspect of the novel and how a kind of overly saturated commercial and consumer culture leads to a kind of instability of a culture, the instability of social relationships among people, a lack of trust in oneself, a lack of trust in authorities, a lack of trust in experts that can fuel a kind of conspiratorial mindset. And certainly we see that in our politics today. So I think that that book is a powerful demonstration of a lot of these forces. I mean, you mentioned what other books, and I can't resist mentioning one, which is called The Art of the Deal, not written by Donald Trump, but published under his name. And certainly the lure of Trump's politics, the attractiveness of it to many people, recalls Barnum's kind of style of charisma. So it's a certain kind of charisma that comes out of capitalism. It comes out of commerce. It is fed by capitalism and commerce. And I think certainly Trump has brought a lot of that into our politics. And it's not much of a stretch to kind of connect that once again to the kind of emphasis that Pynchon puts on conspiratorial.
You also have a section on the River Rouge plant that Henry Ford built in Detroit in the 19-teens, which was overwhelming for a number of observers, from the French architect Corbusier to the American artist Charles Sheeler. And you mentioned that In 1914, when the assembly line, Ford establishes the assembly line, only 29% of his labor force is born in the United States. And the one phrase that the bosses on the assembly line learn how to say in virtually every European language is hurry up. So that from its start, it's not a particularly pleasant place to work. And yet it's a place for which American culture retains an incredible nostalgia. Why do we retain that nostalgia? And what, in your view, should replace manufacturing, the factory, in our mental map of capitalism?
So I'm glad in your question, you raised the percentage of foreign-born workers in Ford's factories. Because I think it's hard for us to appreciate the kind of massive disruption that industrialization caused for people's lives. As you say, the United States industrialized largely on the back of an immigrant workforce from Southern and Eastern Europe. But it's not just that. I mean, the era, and when I say the era, I mean every era before the era of industrialization, even societies were largely rural. If they weren't engaged in settled agriculture, they were engaged in hunting and gathering. And I think that's the right kind of scope for thinking about this question. It was a very new thing for most people to live in cities, to work in factories and work in an environment like Ford's assembly line. It was very disruptive. I think that that is what explains, why the factory, people became the symbol of stability and structure in industrial life. And so it's not just, the era of industrial capitalism from roughly called 1830 until 1970, I suppose I would date it. The factory is certainly the central economic unit, but it's also the central architectural unit of society. And it also becomes a way to think about society itself. I mean, so many of the metaphors that people use to think about society, like structure, right? The word structure comes out of the kind of built environment that Ford created. I think similarly, maybe not in such a profound way, the post-industrial era resonates with the decades leading up to Ford's factory. We've kind of lost industrial structure in many respects. The factory no longer is the central unit of economic life. It's not the central unit of community. And it poses the question, which you posed quite rightly, of what can replace it. I wish I knew. I'm not sure if anybody does know. I would mention maybe one candidate, because you could tell that story that I just told about industrial society using the factory. You could also tell it using the family. The family was another kind of central unit, the male breadwinner, female homemaker family. It was another central unit of industrial society that gave it stability, gave it security. We've increasingly lost that too, but it strikes me perhaps that's the place to look in our present day capitalism.
That's an interesting point. I watched a lecture that Richard White, the retired Stanford historian, gave on his book, The Republic for Which It Stands, which is a survey of Reconstruction in the Gilded Era. And he said that the language of that era was just suffused with literally the word home, with family, with that sensibility. And so, what you're saying is, to some extent, that there was continuity, as radical as the change was in the early 20th century. There was continuity in American culture in that concept of home and family.
I think that's right.
Sort of moving more to the finance side, which you treat extensively in your book, you write, I think about the crisis of 1893, more deflation was the solution to deflation and more bankruptcy was the solution to bankruptcy. The solution that would echo throughout the age of capital through the Great Depression of the 1930s. Where does this strain of austerity in American capitalism come from? And is that instinct related to the continuing appeal of the gold standard to some people?
It's a great question. I mean, I think you could relate it to a Puritan streak in American culture, but yet at the same time, American culture no less is preoccupied with abundance, material abundance. And so there are kind of cross currents or counter currents that perhaps are just as strong. I think that you're right to mention the gold standard. Clearly, many of the moments of austerity across the history of American capitalism, you mentioned one, 1893, but you could also look after the panic of 1873 coming out of the Civil War, certainly the Great Depression. The effort or the desired endpoint was to return or stay on the gold standard and to keep the economy running on a fixed monetary base for fear that if it didn't, you know, quite frankly, chaos would break out. So I think we're dealing with a deeply psychological question. And I think it relates to the last question you asked about the nostalgic attachment to the factory and to Fordism in a larger sense. And also back to confidence games, back to the question about Barnum and Melville too. You know, capitalism depends on confidence in a future that's different from the present or different from the past. Whether that's the expansion of wealth, whether it's technological innovation, whether it's entrepreneurial dynamism. And I think that as exciting and progressive as that can be, it also requires an anchor and a sense of fixity and security. There's many different ways to get that. You can get it from, you know, or people in the past have gotten it from a certain idealized vision of home life, a certain idealized vision of the factory. But I think a hard, fixed monetary standard, it seems to come from nature. There's only so much gold in the world, right? It's a fixed quantity. It also provides that kind of anchor of certainty and stability in the midst of all the disruption and all the uncertainty that is just essential to how a capitalist economy operates.
And yet there are always figures fighting against that conception. Early in your book, you discuss Alexander Hamilton. Later in the book, John Maynard Keynes becomes a really major figure. Could you discuss how you read Keynes and the role he plays in the second half of the book from the Depression on?
So Keynes wrote his greatest treatise, The General Theory, in 1936 in the midst of the Great Depression. And I think Keynes's fundamental insight into the Great Depression was, or his perspective on it, it's absurd that we've just lived in the era that's seen the greatest expansion in human history of potential for production, potential for creating wealth. You know, think of Henry Ford's factories. So why is it that with all of this potential, right, we have the greatest bust in economic history? He mulled over that question all kinds of theoretical and vexed and complex ways. But I think the fundamental insight is actually a moral one, that we no longer live in an era of economic scarcity, that we actually live in an era of economic abundance, and that the fundamental economic problem, that being scarcity, has been solved. And there's no reason why we can't enjoy, a phrase he used, economic bliss. And I guess being an optimist, I'm kind of drawn to that vision, and that many of the problems we have in the economy as it relates to poverty, as it relates to austerity, depressions, booms, and busts, these problems can be solved. I don't think the last 100 years bears out Keynes's optimism. I think the ride's been pretty rough. But nonetheless, I think that insight is correct, that our economy has tremendous productive powers. We can meet most of the basic human wants and needs that exist in an economic respect. And the question that we're really faced with is how to live in a world where economically the biggest problem, again, being scarcity, you know, is largely solved. And that's his perspective. And I think questions that come from that perspective are the right questions to ask. You know, we talked about austerity earlier. That's a completely different mindset, right? I mean, the austerity mindset is we just lived through a boom. There was too much credit, too much spending, too much investment. Now to correct it, we really have to tighten our belts and suffer. And Keynes's message is exactly the opposite. There's no need to suffer as long as we can organize our economy along the right lines.
And Keynes is, of course, the intellectual figure against which Milton Friedman and the other members of the Chicago School of Economics do battle, intellectually speaking. You write about the Chicago School in the book, and obviously you teach the University of Chicago.
No.
What's your view of the Chicago School, and is there any group of economists that has anything like that intellectual or moral authority today.
Yeah, I mean, I think Keynes is a tricky figure in the sense that there's Keynes and then there's Keynesian economists, Keynesian macroeconomists after World War II. And the Chicago School is born mostly as a criticism of Keynesianism, or the dominant kind of paradigm of Keynesian macroeconomics as it was practiced after World War II, which obviously bears Keynes's influence, but I think is different. I would want to kind of separate Keynes out. I think the Chicago School made a number of very powerful criticisms of Keynesian macroeconomics as it was practiced after World War II, that it lacked what Chicago School called micro foundations, that it lacked a kind of connection to the fabric of everyday economic life and transactions, and that actually policymakers suffered from hubris in the decades after World War II, that they thought they had kind of fixed the macro economy or knew how to stabilize it by playing with aggregates like consumption, investment, spending, and so forth. And yet, nonetheless, that wasn't the case. The post-war economy entered trouble, mostly through inflation in the 1970s. But that said, with the Chicago School, I think that you have to distinguish among different members and different generations. So I find a kind of second generation Robert Lucas Chicago School to be much more powerful than the Milton Friedman version, in the sense that Milton Friedman, I think, by the end of his career, was a very powerful rhetorician of the market, but I don't think his economic arguments were as powerful. So that's the Chicago School. You know, today, I think you're right. Certainly there are schools of thought. There are lines in the sand that get drawn between different camps. But I don't think there's anything quite like the unified, coherent school of thought that broke out into the public and exerted influence quite the same way that the Chicago School did in the 1970s, 1980s.
In one of the sections of your book, you discuss the city of Houston, which really becomes the paradigmatic post-industrial city. And you write, the U.S. experienced an economic boom during the 1980s, while other countries did not. There are no Houstons in, say, France. Why did you write about Houston? And is it a topic you hope to return to in future work?
Well, maybe. I mean, I'm born and raised in Houston, so I'm a Houstonian. So that section of the book is a little bit like a love letter to the city, given that I don't live there anymore. It relates to these issues about the industrial and the post-industrial. On the one hand, Houston, of course, is premised on industrialization. It's a city premised upon oil. It's dependent upon fossil fuel inputs, given the sprawl of the city. It's dependence upon automobiles. At the same time, it's a city that's paradigmatically post-industrial because of the degree to which it's not centered on factory communities. I mean, there are factories in the city's East End, certainly because of the refining complexes tied to petrochemicals. But it's a city premised upon services, premised upon real estate, premised upon services having to do with healthcare, having to do with food services. So it's not a city like, say, Pittsburgh, that was anchored in industry and then had to kind of reformulate in a post-industrial era. You know, rather, it's a city that's born in and of the kind of post-industrial moment. And so I think it's a particularly fascinating and emblematic site to examine because you can't lean on that model of industrial society that we talked about earlier as the baseline against which to compare it to. You have to examine it on its own terms. I mean, I'd like to continue to research and work on the history of the city.
No, you have, I don't know whether it would have been 2017, 2018, but you wrote a series of maybe 10 short essays on Houston that are really fascinating. One, because you clearly have a deep affection for the place, and yet you also have, you're ambivalent about it in certain respects. I mean, it seems like you have more to say about it.
Yeah, no, thank you. So I do like the city a lot, and I spend a lot of time there. I have family and close friends there. But at the same time, you know, the ambivalence, it's quite remarkable that climate change entered public and popular discourse in the 1980s. I mean, at the moment at which there was rough scientific consensus in the phenomenon and the beginnings of a kind of a political question. And to me, it's striking that, you know, we think of that era since 1980 that the fastest growing city by many standards, or if not the fastest, one of the fastest growing cities is Houston. And so the city and its history, there's also, you know, a lesson in there, or if not a lesson, an insight into the lack of our ability to cope with the climate crisis and to address it. And that clearly we're going to need different models of growth and development at the level of cities, especially to cope with and mitigate and live with climate change. And I think the growth of Houston displays our inability to do that so far. And it's another aspect of the city's history that I find particularly fascinating.
How would you compare the decline of life expectancy and general health in the United States in the late 19th century to today's phenomenon of deaths of despair?
That's a great question. You know, the phenomenon of deaths of despair, of course, has to do with the just shocking number of deaths in recent decades from suicide, drug overdose, alcoholism, particularly among men, particularly among white men in middle age, who particularly live in regions of the country that have been kind of passed over and left behind by American capitalism the last four decades. And then, of course, you refer to the late 19th century. This is an old debate in economic history. It's called the standard of living debate. You know, did the Industrial Revolution improve living standards? And I think we now know with a fair degree of certainty that the first generation to have lived during industrialization actually suffered. They mostly suffered due to health reasons because they lived in cities before there were public health systems. And so they suffered from a, you know, variety of infectious diseases. And we also know that the quality of food, particularly milk, suffered as well as cities moved from the farm to the factory. Then the second to third generation, we see, you know, massive improvements in living standards. In the United States, this would mean the late 19th to early 20th century during the progressive era with the development of public health systems and with greater regulations on food and drink in particular. I think there may be two lessons to take from that. First is that GDP growth is a very important statistic. It tells us a lot, but it doesn't tell us everything about the standard of living, doesn't tell us everything about the quality of life. And so statistics like that can actually mask some really disconcerting trajectories that are occurring within the economy. And then second, I think it tells you that capitalism as an economic system, I mean, this is my view, is actually amoral. It's a method of production that enterprise gears business towards the future production of profit. And that can work in ways that improve human life, and that can work in ways that can wreak some real negative impacts. And you can see that across history. So it doesn't have to go in one way in particular. And again, this is where I think politics really matters in giving shape to economic life with respect to many of these different measurements.
And that dovetails perfectly with my next question and recalls your earlier comment about the role of the state in the economy. Late in your book, you write that in U.S. history, large-scale public investment had enjoyed political legitimacy only in times of war, not even in the Great Depression. If that still holds, what are the options available to President Biden today or successors who might want to reimagine large parts of the American economy?
Well, it certainly shows how steep the challenge is. You know, the sentence you read from the book, I mean, I think that's right. I think that it's mostly been war and moments of war and sacrifice during war that have created the moments politically where large-scale structural transformations of the economy could occur. And so in that respect, really the right model for the Biden administration to engage is maybe not so much the New Deal, but World War II, and thinking about how to get kind of the kind of leverage to change the economy along the lines that they would like. With that said, while like many people, I've been disappointed to see the lack of national solidarity during COVID. Unfortunately, much like in wartime, there has been a lot of suffering and there has been a lot of death. And there is the possibility that together as a society, that in finding meaning, making that suffering meaningful and trying to find some collective form of redemption, that could be mobilized Biden administration and its economic policy. So I think there is a chance. I don't think it's written in the stars that structural transformation can only happen in wartime. And again, what's important about the war, beyond unfortunately the scale of suffering, is that wars have been moments that, for good and for ill, have brought about solidarity. And I think that that's the issue that politics could, you know, could focus upon and leverage.
It's striking that in corporate governance circles, and even when I talk to individual corporate lawyers, there's a sense that shareholders, large institutional shareholders, are asking companies to do more because those shareholders have lost faith in the ability of governments, not just here, but elsewhere, to address large issues like climate change or economic inequality. Does your history have anything to say about that approach?
Yeah, I mean, I would say two things. One is just to offer context, and the book, the chapters after World War II, you know, discuss the period after the war, 1950s and 1960s, when managers and boards were ascendant, were dominant, in which shareholder power was quite weak, and tracks that through the end of the 20th century to the shareholder revolution of the 1980s, when shareholders really seized power of corporations. Now, the mantra that shareholders used during the 1980s to seize power was shareholder value, which typically meant a short-term profit criteria and imposing a short-term profit criteria on corporations. I think where we're at now is a different moment. I don't think it has historical parallels or historical precedents. And that's where many shareholders asking corporations not so much to focus on profit, but to focus on these larger social issues. So after World War II, it was the managerial class that focused on the social issues. And now we're seeing a different kind of politics, a different kind of shareholder activism. And I actually think the central optic in the book, and this comes from my Keynesian perspective, is investment. And investment being the kind of critical, the most critical factor in economic development. And so I think this politics is sort of full of promise. I think the issue is, and to go get back to the political question, is what is its relationship to democracy? Because if it's just a very narrow set of shareholders making these decisions, carrying out these campaigns, there's a real question of democratic legitimacy at stake. And so the issue becomes, how do you transform this kind of shareholder activism in such a way that it can make a point of contact with democratic politics inside the state, including electoral politics? And I think that's going to be a very important question in the decades ahead in terms of how these things play out.
Despite the fact that in the introduction to your book, you say you wrote a presentist book, it certainly has the footnotes of an academic history. And those footnotes are a treasure trove of reading recommendations. There's one book you recommend about P.T. Barnum that's terrific. What are the five or six secondary sources you read for the book, probably over the course of about a decade, that you most enjoyed, just as a reader?
Okay, I have some books I'd like to recommend along these lines. I love the question. It's very hard to narrow it to five or six, I have to be honest, but I'm going to stay at six. I'm not going to go over. All right. So the first book I want to mention is a book about the history of slavery. And there's this, the first part of the book, The Age of Commerce, focuses a lot on slavery as an economic system and its larger contributions to American history. And that's a book called Saltwater Slavery by Stephanie Smallwood. You know, you ask books that one enjoys. This is a book that's about a tragedy. It's not easy reading, but it's a searing book. It's sort of life inside the Atlantic slave trade from the perspective of the African peoples whose bodies and lives were commodified by the slave trade. So that's one book. The second book is an old book by Stanley Elkins and Eric McKendrick called The Age of Federalism. So that's a kind of like founding fathers book. It's a brilliant book. It's a narrative history of the 1790s after the Revolution and debates among the kind of Hamiltonian and Jeffersonian blocks about what the future of the American economy will be. So I love that book. The third book I want to mention is a book called The Life and Times of Jay Gould by Maury Klein. You know, there's so many biographies about robber barons that people read, and there's a lot of great ones. I think of Ron Chernow's books that kind of stand out, T.J. Stiles as well. This one, I'm not quite sure why this one never achieved that kind of classic status. It's a great read, and it tries to resuscitate the kind of most evil Gilded Age robber baron there ever was, Jay Gould. So Life and Times of Jay Gould. The fourth book is about the New Deal by a German scholar named Wolfgang Schivelbusch. So just the name Schivelbusch, you know, should attract you to the book. It's called Three New Deals. It's a short book that compares FDR's New Deal to Nazi Germany and Italian fascism. It's mostly about architecture, but it draws some really fascinating comparisons and distinctions among these three political regimes during the Great Depression in the 1930s. Next, the fifth book is a book called Running Steel, Running America by Judith Stein. It's a labor history, but also a larger political economic history of steel in the 20th century. But I think it's the best book that I know of about the fate of the New Deal state, the project that was the New Deal, New Deal liberalism, and why it failed, why it broke up in the 1970s and then into the 1980s. And then finally, a book by Thomas Holt called The Problem of Race in the 21st Century. It's a short book that connects the history of race to the history of capitalism, but that is very much a presentist book. And it's written maybe 15, 20 years ago, but I think it was very prescient. So it tries to think about how we should understand race in the 21st century. And it's just an extraordinarily lucid book on these topics. Very, very, there are, you know, obviously very much a public debate and concern.
And you end the book, it's literally, I think on the next to last page of the book, you quote Keynes writing, I think in the late 1930s, decadent international but individualistic capitalism is not a success. But when we wonder what to put in its place, we are extremely perplexed. If I were to put that question to you, how would you answer?
Well, I'll give you a focused answer and a more abstract answer. You know, the most focused answer is I think we need a completely new attitude towards public investment in the United States. I think we have critical needs that can only be met through imaginative forms of public investment that we can't go back to the New Deal. You know, that's not going to happen. That shouldn't happen. But I think that's one place where we need to focus our politics. And I think there we need to invent new institutions that aren't particularly statist, but don't depend upon markets and the currently organized financial system. So that's kind of one place. And then second, I do think we started off talking about the long-term and the kind of long-term vision. And when one thinks about the long-term today, the politics of climate change and the politics of energy, I think stand out. And how we're going to cope with that economically and politically, I think that's going to be the big question going forward. And too soon to tell if the moment we're living in right now is going to mark the beginning of the next age of American capitalism, if we're going to move beyond the period that was opened up in the 1980s. But if that is to be the case, I think historians will look back and see climate change as the critical issue that really led to, you know, some fundamental changes in how American capitalism works.
John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
For Drinks with the Deal, I'm David Marcus.